Thank you very much, Kathleen, particularly for your discretion, for which I'm deeply appreciative. And I also want to thank the APA and the Central Division Program Committee. Is this picking up? Are you hearing? Okay. For offering me this honor, and for you in the audience for optimistically turning out for the event. I have to confess to have been somewhat daunted by the demands of the Dewey Lecture, which proposes that I am to, in their words, reflect broadly and in an autobiographical spirit on philosophy in America. How can I wondered, who has led an uneventful life in the backwaters of philosophy, do any such a thing? After all, the area of philosophy in which I work, the history of early modern philosophy, wasn't even always counted as philosophy by some members of the profession. But from my point of view, I've always considered myself very lucky to have become an historian of philosophy at the time that I did, when a lot of other people who were also taking up this work, and by thinking hard about how the history of philosophy ought to be practiced, have made this field a very exciting and rewarding place to work. I have been fortunate to participate throughout my career in one long learning experience in which I have had the benefit of working within a community dedicated to figuring out how to do good history of early modern philosophy. I thought then that it might be useful to share my learning experience within my own community with the philosophy community at large. So, while I'll proceed according to the demands of the Dewey Lecture in autobiographical fashion, talking about the problems I encountered in carrying out my projects, I want to emphasize that I'm certainly not telling a story about how I forged a field, far from it, but about how I benefited from the work of a great, great many other people. And while I will mention the names of a very few people, I am deeply grateful to many, many others. The story of the development of the history of early modern philosophy over the past few decades is often framed as a struggle between history written by those in the analytic tradition and those who identify as contextualists. There is a great deal that's right about this framework, but it doesn't entirely capture my own experience, so I'll begin there in what may or may not be left field. To start with, I had what I later discovered to be a rather old-fashioned education in philosophy at Bryn Mawr College. At Bryn Mawr, at that time, all philosophy courses were taught using only historical figures. So Introduction to Philosophy was not a problem-oriented course, but a history survey. In courses like ethics or aesthetics or whatever, we studied only historical figures. And I formed the somewhat vague belief that you couldn't actually be a philosopher unless you were dead. But I enjoyed what I was doing as a philosophy major, and so without having the slightest idea what I was doing, I went on to graduate school in philosophy. There I was thoroughly disabused of my notions. Every other graduate student came from an undergraduate program with several prominent philosophers in their departments, none of whom were dead at the time, about whose views they were expert. They laughed at me because they knew there was no such person at Bryn Mawr. So I kept my mouth shut, realized that I was not going to be studying the great dead philosophers, and threw myself into acquiring a knowledge of contemporary philosophy. Indeed, at my program, Brandeis University, there was no other option. There was no one on the faculty who was an expert in early modern philosophy. And Brandeis was no exception. While there were here and there programs with people who considered themselves to be historians of philosophy and who trained students to be historians, by and large, this was not the case. If you went to graduate school in philosophy in the late 60s and 70s, the chances are that you would receive no training of the kind that we like to give our students today. Exposure, yes, but no professional training whatsoever in the history of modern philosophy. What this means is that, in fact, Students were not being taught how to do something that could be called history of philosophy in the analytic tradition. They were not being taught how to do history of philosophy of early modern times at all. Catherine Wilson, in a piece for a volume on analytic philosophy and the history of philosophy, has called attention to this phenomenon and points out how many prominent historians of philosophy who came of age during this period were in fact self-taught. And I would identify myself as well to have been self-taught. But I think this fact explains something about the positive energy in the field. There was no established camp or school telling you how to do history of early modern philosophy, but instead, as even more people started to do serious history of early modern philosophy in the 70s, most were analytically trained philosophers trying to work out the ground rules for this particular endeavor. At this point, an interesting question is, what made this groundswell happen? But I'm afraid instead of answering it, I'm going to have to revert to autobiography, although I would love to hear the stories of others. In my first job at NYU, I was told off, as many untenured faculty have been, to teach the required History of Modern Philosophy course. I'm sure all of you are familiar with this course since it has persisted until today, and it consists of a rapid gallop through 6 or 7 great figures in the history of philosophy. While it was assumed that it was a good thing for undergraduates to acquire some familiarity with those figures, it was also assumed that anyone could teach it, and so I found myself faced with this task. I taught it then, as many did, as a sort of anthology of great problems with which I could puzzle and amuse my students. One day, a senior member of the department, Bill Ruddock, came in to observe my teaching, which happened to be on Locke's account of identity and personal identity. At the end of class, Bill came up to me and murmured that Locke hadn't actually written what I had said Locke believed. At the time, of course, I made some feeble excuse, but I was intrigued. So I went back and I read Locke's chapter on identity. I was amazed. Locke not only didn't say what I thought he said, he actually wasn't saying what a lot of people thought he said either. So I buckled down and worked hard to figure out what Locke actually was saying, and eventually I wrote a paper on Locke on personal identity, and still more eventually I published that paper. At that point, I would say that I had begun to internalize what is probably the first rule for doing good history of philosophy: respect the text. I had taken on board that if you write a paper about someone called John Locke, then the views you attribute to this John Locke should be substantiated by actual things written by John Locke. I had much more to learn, however, about what else is involved in respecting the text, and I would say that I wasn't yet a historian of early modern philosophy, but was still an analytic philosopher who had written a paper on an historical topic. In writing this paper, however, I found that I was doing something I really enjoyed. I liked showing that Locke was smarter than he'd been credited for, more than I liked showing that some contemporary philosopher wasn't quite as smart as had been thought. So I was motivated, but I still didn't have firm ideas about what I ought to be doing. It was at this point that I was able to benefit from work being done by others. I can still remember the kind of jolt provided by reading Michael Ayers' Substance, Reality, and the Great Dead Philosophers. This paper is perhaps remembered for being an early shot across the bows in defense of what we now call contextualism against an ahistorical rational reconstruction approach, but it was also the first explicit attempt that I encountered to lay out what made some ways of writing about great dead philosophers better than other ways. Ayers showed that his target, Jonathan Bennett, made serious mistakes in his account of Berkeley because he had failed to appreciate the full philosophical and, in fact, scientific context within which Berkeley was working, and so Bennett misunderstood the concepts Berkeley was employing. Ayers was not so much saying that Bennett was doing the wrong kind of history of early modern philosophy as that he wasn't doing history of philosophy at all. Bennett's goal was to treat Berkeley as a colleague and to subject his views to stern criticism. Ayers was trying to show that it is not enough to be a smart philosopher with good critical skills to be able to pick up an historical text and figure out what is wrong with its arguments. Good criticism requires understanding, and understanding requires knowledge. What made Ayers' account of Bennett's mistakes convincing was that he was able to unfold the actual coherent line of argument to be found in the passages Bennett had decried as conflations and confusions, so that we could appreciate Ayers' own understanding of the text and the knowledge on which it was based. What Ayers had shown was that there was a good way and a bad way to interpret an historical text, and that the good way involves treating historical texts as belonging to and reflecting the age in which they were written, whereas the bad way assumed that philosophical texts were timelessly accessible to all. And he had shown this convincingly because he had showed that the first way of reading a text results in a much better philosophy than the second. Soon, more and more work appeared that was not open to Ayers' kind of criticism. Such work might be said to have taken on a second rule for doing history of philosophy: respect the context. Taking on board Ayers' strictures not only encouraged more careful work on historical texts, but also opened up new questions and lines of research about those texts. Soon there was new work coming from Ayers and many others asking how an appreciation of the scientific context against which Locke worked affected an understanding of key metaphysical concepts Locke used, like substance and essence. As I joined in this endeavor, I began to recognize the complications that are involved in respecting the context. After all, contexts are not just sitting around waiting to be deployed. Obviously, the contextual material itself must be carefully read and interpreted. Consistency would seem to require that this material too be placed in its proper context. But if this is so, is there any way to stop? Does contextualism collapse of its own weight? Moreover, the context to be considered could include just those other texts that might be relevant to a study of the target text, or what Michael Edwards has called thin contextualism, or it might also go on to include Edwards' thick contextualism, that is, consideration of things like the social and political milieu or material culture, for which Daniel Garber has argued and many have made good use of. It seems then that there is no reason to call a halt to the examination of an historical context. On the other hand, life is short, and in practice, historians have to make decisions about how far they are going to carry on their researches. It seems to me that they typically make these decisions based on their own interests and predilections, deriving from the kind of inquiries they like to make. In my own case, because I like to focus on elucidating a particular text, I tend to limit the context for which I make myself responsible to what, in my judgment, will make a significant difference to my understanding of the text. Others enjoy a wider focus. In general, respecting the context has meant respect the context in which your project is located. Contextualism, as I see it in practice, is not a prescription of one right way to do the history of philosophy, so much as a compendium of best practices. Indeed, respecting the context is at best a signal to cope with a number of different difficulties, as I discovered when I set about to unravel some of Locke's difficult positions. First, if an understanding of the context of philosophical positions is to be helpful, it's necessary to make decisions about which of a sea of materials will form the appropriate context to illuminate a particular text. After all, just because Locke is the philosopher that students read before they read Berkeley doesn't mean that the only philosopher Berkeley himself read was Locke. In Berkeley's own case, we do get some help from reading notebooks he kept, where it emerges that he read very widely, and material like this should always be consulted. But frequently, such help is not available. Then, identifying the appropriate context has to be read back from the issues discussed in the text itself. This is obviously a delicate matter. You want to understand the matter with which an author has engaged in order to understand a text, but your understanding of the text is going to influence your ideas about the surrounding issues. Still worse, The authors of texts do not simply take over and believe everything they see around them. Deciding how a particular context informs a text will differ depending upon the attitude towards the context you take an author to be holding. If, for example, your views on Locke's account of substance will differ depending upon whether you think he was supportive or critical of the science of his day. Respecting the text and respecting the context requires an elaborate dance between the two. So it becomes clear that just picking up the text and commenting on it, what you find there, is not going to cut it. Many of these problems became acute for me when I embarked on my first long project, a book-length study of Berkeley's new theory of vision. The issue of context is instantly important because the claim Berkeley starts by making, that distance is not immediately perceived by sight, has struck many contemporary readers as obviously incredible. After all, we do it all the time. Berkeley is only saved from lunacy when it is observed that the claim he is making is one that he says is agreed by all. The careful historian says, what's that word immediately doing there? And who were all those other people who agreed with Berkeley? That is, what has to be recognized is that Berkeley is not talking about ordinary common sense beliefs, but about what he has found among other theoreticians using a technical way of speaking. But we are not out of the woods yet, because Berkeley provides a specific characterization of the views that share this account of immediate distance perception, but with whom he himself disagrees. He calls them optic writers. As it happens, none of the people whose name appears in Berkeley's reading notebooks hold precisely the position he attributes to these optic writers. In fact, their ideas tend to be much messier than what Berkeley reports. So we have to figure out what it was in the various claims made by the people he read that led him to describe them in the way that he did, because he is as much constructing as responding to an opposing position. This is just the beginning, however, of the troubles that exist for anyone trying to make sense of the new theory, as I was. First and primarily, we have to figure out what the book is about. Many commentators focus on Berkeley's account of distance perception, with which he begins the book, and this is a matter, of course, of continuing interest. It is also Berkeley's own practice when he returns to material from the new theory in later works to focus on distance perception. But the first sentence of the book tells us explicitly that it is about distance, size, and situation perception, and as well about the difference between ideas of sight and touch and whether there is anything about anything these ideas have in common. What is a book that covers all of these topics about? Answering this question requires following another rule, a refinement on respect the text, namely, read the whole book. I would go so far as to say that this rule is essential, even when the whole book is long and ungainly, like Locke's essay. In fact, I would go so far as to say that you need to read the whole book from beginning to end, paying strict attention to what comes after what. There are obviously many intriguing problems and puzzles that might occur within the few pages of a book that are well worth examining in depth. The new theory is full of them, and many people have written very insightfully about these problems. But you can only understand Berkeley's position with respect to these puzzles if you know why he is raising them, and this requires knowing what role the puzzle you are interested in plays in his overall argument. There are other matters that come up in the course of settling what the book is about, as why did Berkeley write this book? What is the motivation that led Berkeley to take up this problem at this time, and what did he hope to accomplish? And since typically an author's goals don't fluctuate wildly, how does the material in this book contribute to the overall project of the rest of the author's work? These are questions that are particularly germane to an understanding of a work like The New Theory, since on the face of it, the work appears to present a solution to some problems in space perception, with no metaphysical surprises, while the book's Berkeley wrote that follow are, of course, very different and rely on a startling metaphysics. One of the ways in which the works can be reconciled is by following out a hint in a letter Berkeley wrote, in which he says that the apparent uselessness of the new theory can be understood by means of what he writes in the Principles. What he apparently meant by this is that the Principles, by calling attention to contributions of an omnipresent and benevolent God, will recall people to their moral duties, and that the new theory provides support for this conclusion. The possibility of this line of argument calls attention to two important issues an historian needs to pay attention to. The first is, don't neglect the correspondence of authors you are interested in. And one of the important tasks early modern historians have taken on is to provide modern editions of exchanges of letters. The second is more far-reaching. I have already mentioned the importance of recognizing that the boundaries between early modern philosophy and early modern science are blurred at best. The same is equally true for theology and religious issues. It is equally important not to miss motivations that are theological in nature, especially since theological motivations are less likely to be among those moving contemporary philosophers than are scientific motivations. While the new theory could be read simply as a contribution to early modern optics, this would leave out a prime reason for Berkeley's undertaking such a project, inasmuch as he thinks that a proper understanding of how we perceive the world by sight will lead to a much richer understanding of our place in the natural world and our relationship to that world's creator. Neglecting the broader motivations lying behind the new theory can lead to confusions about what that book is about and to a neglect of important connections between it and Berkeley's later works. I've been developing now an account of various ways in which I learned how to do the history of early modern philosophy. But the view that historians of philosophy must have special skills, which I have been endorsing, that will allow them, above all, to avoid misunderstandings based on anachronisms, seems to have as a consequence that the work of historians of philosophy and the philosophers they study are completely cut off from the rest of current philosophers. I had some occasion to confront this issue somewhat tangentially when I was invited to spend a year at an interdisciplinary research center of the University of Bielefeld as a member of a group of philosophers and psychologists studying foundational issues in perception. To begin with, and seen from the inside, all was not clear sailing. There was a certain amount of restiveness at being assembled daily into a large group of people when it was not at all obvious how such a mixed group could be at all helpful to any one person's particular research projects. While there were general ways about talking about what each group could do, the philosophers could provide conceptual clarity, the psychologists could provide empirical data, neither group was especially eager to take on these helpmate tasks. People, it seems, prefer to do their own work rather than serve in some sort of ancillary role to someone else's project. I mention this experience now because I think it had, for me, implications for the related problem I just mentioned that faces historians of philosophy. As I said, learning to be a good historian of philosophy will inevitably render your work and the work of the great dead philosophers less accessible to the rest of the philosophy profession. The charge that used to be leveled at historians of philosophy, that they were mere scholars and not philosophers at all, seems to be coming to pass through their own efforts. There are two separate issues here facing this dilemma that I want to pull apart. The first questions whether historians of philosophy are in fact philosophers at all. After all, historians of science are not in general today working scientists, but historians. Maybe, like these historians of science, historians of philosophy belong in history departments. This issue can be dispelled fairly easily. The history that historians of philosophy seek to explain is the history of philosophical discourse. In order to be able to offer their accounts, historians of philosophy need to be able to do things like figuring out what claims are being made on the basis of what arguments, to see how the work as a whole can be seen as a piece of rational persuasion, and to be able to clarify what in these endeavors seems obscure. That is, historians of philosophy engage in a philosophical discussion with the objects of their study. Since this actually requires philosophical skills, you have to know how to do philosophy to practice them. It is fitting, therefore, that historians of philosophy should be themselves philosophers, trained and housed in philosophy and not history departments. So I will continue on as a member of the APA to make my remarks. The harder question is, do historians of philosophy have anything to contribute to the rest of the philosophy department? What do they have to offer their colleagues? Many historians of philosophy want to say that they do indeed have important contributions to make to philosophers today. One suggestion that is often made is that arguments and positions taken in the past can add support for similar positions taken today. There are, however, costs to this kind of proposal. For one thing, the history of philosophy is filled with dead ends and roads not taken. An ambition to serve present-day philosophers can lead to an incomplete or misleading account of what really happened. Still worse, such a goal is prone to encouraging anachronisms. The desire to align the work of the past with what's happening now can result in a misuse of the principle of charity, in which claims made in historical texts that appear implausible or downright weird are reinterpreted in accordance with contemporary intuitions. But of course, the past, as L.P. Hartley reminds us, is a foreign country. They do things differently there. Others have proposed instead that what is valuable from the past is precisely that it lays out a story of roads not taken. Historians can provide other philosophers with accounts of alternatives that can provoke in their colleagues an awareness of the contingency of their own views, or give them opportunities to notice that they may be relying on long-held assumptions that actually stem from obsolete frameworks. Daniel Garber, for example, has suggested, echoing Hartley, that a study of history of philosophy can be broadening in the same way that foreign travel is broadening. I have qualms about this kind of suggestion, too, in part because it's never clear to me how this benefit is supposed to work. Presumably, most philosophers are not being encouraged to just pick up and read historical texts, since historians have been very busy explaining to them that they won't understand what they're reading. So, it must fall to the historians to provide travelers' guides to others. I worry that this is assigning to historians of philosophy what is essentially a helpmate role, in addition to their own demanding projects. John Cottingham, moreover, has raised a different worry, and I'll give it to you in his own words. Travel broadens the mind only for those who are already open to having their minds broadened. If you go to southern Spain solely for sunbathing and cheap beer, you will not tend to be struck by the ancient cities and their exquisite interplay of Islamic and Christian cultures. To put this point more charitably, since I don't want to suggest that contemporary philosophers are only interested in cheap beer, not at all. If you have already carefully worked out a set of parameters that deeply interest you, you are unlikely to treat as anything more than a curiosity the news that someone 300 years ago treated things differently. There is, however, one positive point to be gained from this observation, which is supported by my experience at my interdisciplinary research interest. I've been maintaining that there is no one job that all historians of philosophy must undertake on behalf of their colleagues. But it is entirely likely that any one person can find themselves struck by something they have learned from someone else's work. An unexpected way of thinking about things can, as it were, twist the kaleidoscope of your framework and bring new considerations into view. I, for example, learned things about color perception at the institute I visited that led me to think about what Descartes and Berkeley said about color in new ways. These sorts of interactions come about person to person, feeding ongoing projects, however, and not subdiscipline to subdiscipline. Nobody takes on the job of being a helping hand. All that is necessary is that we all exhibit a certain amount of intellectual curiosity about what our colleagues are up to. What then becomes of the question, why do history of philosophy if it is not to offer a helping hand to others? I don't see this as a very difficult question to answer. The history of past philosophers is part of our philosophical heritage. To suppose that there is no reason to preserve, understand, and explain our philosophical heritage is clearly ludicrous. History of philosophy as an independent, sui generis branch of philosophy is valuable in its own right. There is, of course, a further question here which impacts another project of mine, and that is, what is our philosophical heritage? Does it consist, in the case of early modern philosophy, of the seven canonical thinkers recognized for their greatness studied in a typical early modern course? These kinds of questions have relevance for the project of identifying women philosophers in the early modern period, a project that I, in fact, embarked on well before I completed some of the work I have been talking about. There were a couple of things that suggested this project to me way back when. I had been teaching a course in the history of feminist thought, which showed me that there were women in the early modern period with philosophical interests, such as Mary Astle. And of course, there were recovery efforts well underway in other disciplines, like literature and art history, so why not philosophy? There was, however, one drawback from my endeavors that I suffered from. I have already confessed that I was self-taught, and so had enjoyed no instruction in digging into the unknown. And as well, at the time, the internet did not exist as the resource we have today, which makes our work so much easier. My recovery method, therefore, was somewhat primitive. I went to the Newberry Library in Chicago and searched the card catalog, a now obsolete device, but very handy at the time. For women's names attached to titles that sounded as though they might be works of philosophy, you know, and then I had them bring me the books. By these rough and ready means, I did indeed uncover a number of pieces of philosophy written by women. At this point, I had some luck. My home library had, among its holdings, the Wing Collection, a collection of books printed during the period I was interested in, preserved on microfilm. While microfilm, if anybody has had the horror of using it, is a far from ideal medium, I was able to print out a number of these works and read them at my leisure. Before I go on to talk about what I did next, I want to explain something about my project as I was working on it then and as I conceived it. My question when I got started was a very simple one. Are there any women at all doing philosophy in the early modern period? And by this I meant, are there women engaging in the same sort of activity that the great dead canonical philosophers of the early modern period practiced? My own goals were quite limited compared to others who have uncovered a much more complete account of the presence of women in philosophy and who have been interested in broadening the way to understand what philosophy is and how it can be practiced. My primitive method sufficed because while locating the women I did was a discovery process for me, inasmuch as some of the names of the women and more often their books were unfamiliar to me, the women I ended up being interested in might be said to be hiding in plain sight. Most of the women I was looking at had connections with better known men of the period, and so their names have survived in the existing literature. Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia was, of course, a familiar figure through her correspondence with Descartes, but Margaret Cavendish's name was known because of her visit to the Royal Society, which was described by Virginia Woolf. And also, of course, through her husband, the Duke of Newcastle, she had access to the Cavendish circle. Anne Conway's letters to Henry Moore had already been published some time ago by Marjorie Hope Nicholson, although we now have an up-to-date modern edition from Sarah Hutton. Damaris Masham was known as a correspondent of Locke's and as the woman who gave him a home in his declining years. and Catherine Trotter Coburn was thanked by Locke for her published defense of him as a critic. These women were not, any of them, unknown in their day, in their circles, and were participants in existing philosophical communities. This is even true of the woman who was most obscure to me, Lady Mary Shepherd. I discovered one book she had published in the Newbury Library, and Eileen O'Neill kindly gave me the name of another. Initially, and when I first started writing about her, this was absolutely all I knew, two books. I was, however, eventually able to learn more, and as her name became more salient, it emerged that she was, for example, the subject of an article in Robert Blakey's History of the Philosophy of the Mind. William Hewell praised her work. She corresponded with Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and Samuel Coleridge wrote doggerel in her honor. She, too, was part of a lively community about which we can hope to learn much more. Even though these women had become forgotten, they held a conspicuous place among the philosophers of their day. So now, I had acquired some knowledge about largely forgotten women philosophers of the early modern period, and the question was, what did I want to do next? My chief concern was that these women should cease to be forgotten, that their names and their very existence should become sufficiently familiar that it would no longer be possible to wonder whether there were any early modern philosophers. What I eventually did, encouraged by Kathleen, was to approach Hackett Publishing Company with a suggestion that I put together a small anthology of writings of early modern women philosophers that could provide supplementary materials to be used in courses in early modern philosophy. Hackett had previously published such an anthology of scientific writings, so I hoped they would be receptive, as indeed they were. I knew that adding materials to an already full agenda would be difficult, so I chose relatively brief selections from the women's writings, and I tried to choose readings that reflected on the work of the canonical or more familiar figures that were already covered in the course. What I hoped was that if I made things as easy as possible for most instructors, they would be willing to include at least some women on their syllabus. Since the time that my book came out, there has been much more recovery work, thank heavens. There have been many modern editions of the work of women I anthologized and many other women besides. There have been numerous articles written about them and an increasing number of valuable monographs published. Many conferences have taken place. This work is ongoing and growing all the time. But my anthology is still in print and still used, so it seems suitable to confront the question, why include women in history of philosophy courses? If, as I said earlier, an important point of doing history of philosophy is to preserve our philosophical heritage, why extend the scope beyond the canonized grades? There is one obvious answer. The belief, at one time so prevalent, that there were no women doing philosophy is false. It is surely the duty of historians to correct false beliefs about the past, and one way to do this is by making the existence of women philosophers visible. But having said that, the way in which I framed my anthology has raised concerns in me as well as in others that reflect on the larger issue. The first is that restricting the women to be covered in an early modern course to those who are already in conversation with the canonical philosophers will include only women who participated in a restrictive version of philosophy, and so preclude the possibility of enlarging the concept of philosophy itself to include what are more women-friendly activities, belles lettres, poetry, and the like. This worry is one that bothers me less than some others. Enlarging the scope of philosophy is a fine endeavor, I have no problems with that, but a primary concern in my view is to get women recognized as doing philosophy at all. It is this recognition that can speak against a view, which I don't support, that women are not suited to philosophy as traditionally carried out and only flourish in other genres. So I think it's important to study women philosophers whose work is of a piece with their male colleagues so that it can't be asked, yes, but are they really philosophers? That is, if it's clear John Locke is a philosopher, so is Catherine Trotter Coburn, no problems. Other concerns worry me more. Many people have pointed out that by including only short snippets from the women, and snippets, moreover, that reflect the ideas of the male philosophers, the suggestion is inevitable that there is a kind of two-tier vision of the period, with the greater men and the lesser women. I think this criticism is absolutely right. And I think this is also a concern whenever we try to intermingle the canonical philosophers with others of their period. A gender imbalance makes this worry all the more serious, but there is always a danger to, I think, that we are very prone, for we historians love our canonical figures, of distorting the thought of a period by telling a story that seems to present the major philosophers and their helpers. Any such story, I fear, whether it's the familiar one or a new narrative, will be distorting, because it will impose from the outside a set of judgments about what is important and what is not. Preserving our philosophical heritage requires more than preserving that which we have at one time or another taken to be valuable, but looking for value wherever we find it. Scholars already working closely with the text of women philosophers and other non-canonical figures have been able to demonstrate the interest and importance of their work. We shouldn't be taken in by the framework we have inherited in defining our philosophical heritage. Since I began my story of my life in the history of philosophy by talking about a bad way of teaching the standard history of early modern philosophy course, it seems clear that we're now heading straight at a discussion of how changes in the way we do history of philosophy has or ought to change the way we teach it. Stephen Nadler has already addressed this body on the topic in his presidential address, so I will be brief. The standard Descartes-Kant course is a terrible course. It was codified before the time when historians of philosophy had begun to work out the standards for doing good history of philosophy, and in fact, it breaks all the rules. It covers too many figures in too short a time, and so does not allow students to grasp any of the skills that are necessary to working closely with difficult historical texts. If there are too many figures on the one hand, on the other, it excludes many more. The standard course seems to have been designed to illustrate a largely epistemological narrative, one that reflects not even present-day epistemology, but a kind of mid-century modern version. It thus imposes serious distortions on the philosophy as practiced in the early modern period and makes it impossible to draw adequately on relevant areas such as natural science, theology, and politics. Something must be done. One solution, which has been growing in popularity and which has many attractive features, has been to structure the early modern course using different narratives than the standard one. Lisa Shapiro has been arguing in favor of this approach and has suggested several alternative narratives, one that foregrounds scientific work, which I think has been growing in any case, or one that centers on issues of freedom, education, and autonomy. While I think there's a lot to like about this idea, I do think there are some drawbacks. For one thing, any narrative is going to be imposed upon material and so risks distortion. Also, I would worry that the temptation would be to tell a complete story about the subject of the narrative, and so the new course might become as overstuffed with figures as the old survey. The new course would then inherit some flaws from the old one, as not allowing the students enough breathing room to grapple with the texts. The solution towards which I'm currently inclining is to abandon survey and narrative altogether. Instead, the best thing to do, I'm now imagining, would be to teach three or four texts, each of which can be read from cover to cover. That way, any author of any gender can be treated with the respect they deserve. This approach, too, is not without drawbacks, of course. For one thing, the authors are not set into conversation with each other, so I expect this debate to be ongoing. Look forward to it. I have described to you my life as an historian of early modern philosophy, a life that, as I hope you can see, is both highly rewarding and not very easy. This is exactly what we should expect, since, as Spinoza taught us a long time ago, all things excellent are as difficult as they are rare. Thank you.